Mr. Watson, Real 7. We were talking about your time, around the Cully area, but immediately after having landed, when you were with the A echelon of 2nd 5 and 4 4 Yeomanry, and we were talking about the difficulty in digging slit trenches. You've got a couple more points. So.
Yeah, the other point about digging slit trenches, the Army, in their wisdom or unwisdom, never provided one with pickaxes. They provided one with mattocks. Now, a mattock has a blade in one direction on one side of the mattock and a blade in the other direction on the other side of the mattock. The idea being that man can cut with one blade and dig with the other blade. But the trouble is with mattocks, that unlike a pickaxe which had a blade one side and a point the other, you cannot penetrate hard ground. A pickaxe would have penetrated the hard ground, but a mattock wouldn't. That is probably one of the reasons why we were unable to dig. We were also equipped with shovels, but if, in retrospect, one of them had a fork and a pickaxe, one would have achieved much easier digging than was the case with a mattock and a shovel. But the ground was extremely hard. I never successfully completed one slip trench the whole time I was in France.
What about latrines, latrine arrangements?
Well, when one's moving like that, one doesn't. One does it where one can. There's no question of them visiting purpose-dug latrines. We were obviously when one was stationary. There were latrines, I can't remember coming across a lot of latrines in France, but they were on the move most of the time.
Now, there was a quiet bit at first before Epsom. Anything else about that?
No, I can't recollect anything else about it. That I think we may have gone a couple of days after the region, but I can't remember a lot else about it. All I know is that the honey tank I had disappeared and I was travelling around with A Echelon.
Was there anybody who was in charge of you in A Echelon at the time?
I don't know.
Right. So it's a vague period for you.
No, there must have been a captain or a lieutenant in charge of A Echelon, but I can't remember.
Or an NCO you knew?
Oh, no NCOs. I knew nobody there. I can't recollect anybody.
Now, Epsom was the first big battle. Now, I know you weren't in it in that way, but what do you remember of that time?
Well, I know that we went up to Hill 112.
You don't remember the first couple of days?
No, I can remember us going up to Hill 112. I can remember the BBC war correspondent coming up there. I think his name was Gardner, and a name like that. He was coming up there and he was hiding up there, describing over the microphone his experiences on Hill 112. I can remember the Germans attacking us with moaning minis.
What were they like?
Just made a lot of noise. But I think the noise was more intimidating than the end result. They were a shell of rocket-propelled grenade which just had fins on that whistled, but in some ways they gave you a warning of what was to happen. You heard them, they didn't intimidate me at all. I can remember a beam gun cloud belonging to the infantry running away and retreating from the Germans and the camouflage netting becoming involved in the tracks. And I and one other of these boats went forward to disentangle it, which we did quite successfully, and drove the beam gun carrier up the hill a bit and just left it for the infantry to recover. Why they ran away from it, I don't know. There's no, not that I could see any immediate danger. I can also remember being attacked by the moaning minis just after we brewed up a nice cup of tea and the tea ending up in my helmet, which was inverted on the ground at the side. So I couldn't put my helmet on because it was full of hot tea. I wasn't going to waste the tea.
And what were you actually doing on Hill 112?
Nothing. We were sat there with Aeschron, and then we went back with them. I suppose they were up there with the lorries and feeding the tanks with fuel, food or ammunition. And then we went back from it. I can't remember a lot about it.
Now, were you actually doing any duties in this, in refuelling or...
No specified duties. I suppose that we were being carried about as reinforcements and for immediate use. But it took a long time before I was immediately used.
Now, what's the next thing you remember? There was then another period of bits and bobs of action and things.
In action, that's right.
And then there was Goodwood.
We were at the back of it. Now, when Goodwood took place, we never went over the river a lot. The people I was with never went over the river. We saw and heard about Goodwood, but we weren't over the river. Now, what I can remember more about Goodwood than anything is the air attack that took place at night following the first day's action, because we saw that from, I think it must have been an elevated position, and we wondered what the hell was happening, because we heard all these planes coming down, and we could see the flashes of the bombs, we could see the searchlights, hear the anti-aircraft fire and the rest of it. We didn't know that it had such serious effects on the passing fighter.
But you weren't in it?
We weren't there, no.
How did you feel, when you heard about the casualties of Goodwood? Because, a lot of the regiment were...
Well, I think we lost in 2 days, we lost 50 tanks. To say the least of it, we were horrified and apprehensive for ourselves. Obviously, we were potential tank crew, so we weren't very happy about it. One could say the least one's apprehensive. One could say also one was scared, which is probably nearer the truth.
So
some people pretend that they're looking forward to a good fight. I never did. I was always apprehensive.
So what's the next thing that happened? Did that mean you became, were given a job after
no,
that?
No, I was still not given a job. This in view of the large numbers of casualties, mind you, they lost the tanks as well. In view of the large numbers of casualties, I thought I would be immediately called up to serve in a tank, but I wasn't. But I just stayed in that position for till August the 1st, I think.
What happened on August the 1st? Anything that happened before August?
Yes, because we transferred from after Goodwood, we transferred from the east of the bridgehead to the west, to around Comal. And during the, I was still in the A echelon, but during the fighting around Comal, we were attacked, or the regiment was attacked by American fighters.
And you were still with Aeschron?
Yeah, I was still with Aeschron.
What do you remember of that attack?
Well, I wasn't there. All I know is, as a result of that attack, the sergeant who drove the intelligence officer was wounded. And I was called up straight away to drive the intelligence officer. Somebody must have noted that I had scout car driver experience.
Now, so there's two things there. Who was the intelligence officer you were going to drive?
I've got an idea his name was Hudson. Lieutenant Hudson.
And what type of armoured car were you, or tank were you?
This wasn't a dingo, this was a Humber scout car.
Had you driven one of those before?
No.
So, what did you think of the Humber Scout car? A description of it.
Yeah, the Humber Scout car was powered by a six-cylinder Humber Snipe engine. It weighed about 3 tonnes, had armour plate around it suitable for determining rifle or machine gun fire, not armour piercing. It had an ordinary gearbox, four-speed forward gearbox. It didn't go as fast as the Dingo in reverse. It had a reverse gear. It had a two-wheel, four-wheel drive change lever. In other words, one could engage two wheels or four wheels. It was nevertheless much more spacious inside than a Dingo. There was more room inside it, more room for the commander and more room for the driver. The driving position was quite comfortable, but the vision wasn't all that bright. The small and windscreen, for want of a better description, was extremely small, and probably about 12 inches by 6 inches, which didn't, of course, give you a lot of lateral vision.
Did you prefer it to the Dingo, or...?
Well, in some ways, it was better than the Dingo. In other ways, not. I think I preferred the Dingo to the Humber. The Dingo was a much more manoeuvrable thing. The Humber Scout car was longer. It didn't have the speed in reverse. It didn't have... I wouldn't think it had the same forward speed as the... nevertheless, it was quite a comfortable, quite an easy-to-drive vehicle. And it was easy to maintain as well.
Now, you were... driving the intelligence officer, this is Lieutenant Hudson.
Yes.
Which that meant, were you with the headquarters squadron?
HQ squadron, yeah. See, the intelligence officer's jobs were mainly to distribute the maps, to gain intelligence. I don't know whether he interrogated, I don't think this intelligence officer spoke German, nor did his successor. But I take it that he had to apply his knowledge and to gain as much intelligence and to assist the regiment as possible.
Did he command the reconnaissance troop, or was that a separate thing?
No, the reconnaissance troop was a completely different unit. That was commanded by a captain.
So he was just in the...
It was attached to HQ squadron with a scout car as the intelligence officer.
And what was this Hudson, Lieutenant Hudson? No, you're not quite sure on that. We can check that later. We'll call him Hudson for the minute.
Yeah.
What was he like?
Well, you've seen a photograph of him. He was... I never found him very easy to get on with. Most tanks and scout cars, one was fairly close to the officer, and the normal officer other ranks arrangement was probably forgotten because of the proximity, but I did not find Hudson a very unbending character. He kept himself to himself and expected me to keep myself to myself. He didn't unbend at all, fairly aloof the whole time, not the sort of person who I would become friendly with.
Now, how did you take to your new duties then? Because this period, you went there about the 1st of August.
1st of August.
So that's basically during the period of...
the action around Cologne, yeah, for the West.
And the fighting around Bercy and Via and all Labrière, leading up to the big advance to Amiens. Now, what do you remember any of these things?
Not a lot. I can remember a hell of a lot of the smell of death, because I think the Germans suffered fairly severely there. A lot of cattle killed there, and there's a smell of humans and a smell of and things were fairly there was a lot of shots and fire going on there. One had to keep, I can remember we were in a field at one time, and the Germans were mortaring us, and we obviously got into the scout car and shut it all up and just sat there and hoped one didn't land on the roof. But there were some fairly protracted engagements litigations in that area, quite a lot. We suffered a fair number of casualties, I think, in there. Nothing like it was Goodwood, but the fact still remains that the casualties practically every day.
And what were you actually doing most of the time?
Driving in, telling the soldiers around, and he would tell me, do this, go there, do that, dish out these maps, sort this lot of maps, and that sort of thing. Because there are hundreds of maps to sort, you see.
So he'd take the maps round to the...
to the various ships.
So how exactly would that work? Where would he get the maps from?
Well, I don't know where he got them from, but he'd bring a big load of maps which had to be sorted, and then we had to dish them out.
Sorted in what way?
Well, if you get two or three maps, they would get these maps for a fairly large scale, and if you were expected to advance so far, you get maps for the immediate area, maps for the next area, and maps for the next area after that. Now, they obviously had to be sorted because one would get a bundle of A, a bundle of B, a bundle of C, and one had to dish them up into A, B, C, A, B, C, so that they could be distributed to various people. I don't know that every tank had a map, but they were distributed, obviously, to the squadron leaders and certain other people.
The troop commanders? Would the troop commander?
Yeah, probably, but that, I mean, we never used to dish them out individually. They were probably given to A-Echelon, who dished them out with the rations and the ammunition. But they had to be subdivided up and sorted.
Anything else the intelligence officer and you had to do regularly?
Well, I don't know that he ever engaged in with prisoners. He used to obviously collect the insignia of the German regiments from the dead. And try to find out where they came from, things like that. But he always kept himself very much to himself. He never had a chat with me and say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It was just an order to...
Would you help collect the insignia from corpses?
No, I never did, no.
So you'd just drive him about. Now, he wasn't on a reconnaissance thing at all.
No, we didn't ever do any reconnaissance, no.
So, what's the next thing you remember then in this period?
Well, I can remember we went right through that whole area, and I can remember going up through what had been the Falaise pocket.
Now, there was meant to be quite a lot of death and destruction.
Well, there was.
What was that like in that area?
There was a lot of death and destruction. And what you've got to remember then, too, that a lot of the Germans suffered with a shortage of petrol. And they used horse transport to a good degree, which I hadn't appreciated fully. Now, this horse transport, along with what noise they had and their tanks and half tracks and the rest of it, used to be shot up by either our ground forces or by the Royal Air Force. And I remember more than anything is when one went along the road, one didn't see a dead horse. One saw the skeleton of a dead horse. And this baffled me for a long time until somebody said, well, you do realise that the French eat horse meat. And then, of course, I received the answer. That's why there were no horses there. There were only skeletons of horses. They didn't do the same with the Germans, basically. But there was a lot of death and destruction along with those, certainly, caused by various means. But there was a lot of it.
Did you come under fire much during that whole month?
No. Apart from the mortar attack, I don't think we ever experienced any machine gun or rifle fire.
Now, would the next thing then be the big advance to Amiens?
Yeah.
Or is there anything before that?
Well, we went over the... I can remember going over the bridge at... the name of the bridge? V-E-R-N-O.
Vernon.
That's where we crossed the Seine on a Bailey bridge.
Why do you remember that in particular?
Well, because I can remember going across a large river on a pontoon bridge, on the Bailey Bridge. and to see all the tanks and a whole regiment going across this, because there's one hell of a traffic jam on the western side of the Sound, because we weren't the only people that wished to go across it. I would think it was used for 24 hours out of 24, and it was quite impressive. And of course, we were all funneled into one narrow spot, and it would have been an open invitation for the Germans if they'd have had an air force to have bombed not only the bridge, but the whole of the concentration of stuff to the west of it. When we got to the other side, obviously we fanned out a bit, took different centre lines.
And then, what next?
Well, I can remember we were advancing through various villages.
How did the French receive you?
Lots of very, very enthusiastic Frenchmen.
How did they show it? I mean, you know.
Well, there were flowers, bottles of wine, food if you wanted it. Not much food. They used to give you the French loaves. I always like French bread, but their flour was a bit what's his name. One small incident I can remember, because having worked in a Belgian bank, I spoke reasonable French, and I'd improved it in France. And of course, what happened, I used to speak French to the locals when I got the opportunity. And I was speaking French to one local, and he said, "There's no need for you to speak like that to me." And he was a Scot who'd married a French woman in the First World War and stayed there ever since. And when I asked him if the Gestapo or the Germans had ever cottoned on, he said, "No," he said, "I have never been interviewed, stopped, asked, or anything." I said, "And do you speak French?" He said, "Yes," but he said, I don't speak French very well. I still speak it, like a Scot." But he'd gone right through the whole of the war without being stopped by the Germans at all, which, to my mind, indicated something. But he was quite interesting. I can also remember the one of our majors in very, very poor French. We were in a little village which had just been liberated, and he had to get up and give a speech, and he was kissed by all the pretty girls of the village, and flashed quite well. Also in the same village, there were some resistance fighters with some Germans, and I was a bit worried, because I thought, oh, these resistance fighters, they're going to kill these Germans. So I said to them, what are you going to do with these Germans? And they said, "Oh, we're going to put them in the town jail." I said, "You're not going to kill them?" They said, no, certainly not. We're not that sort of people." So that placated my worries somewhat, because I don't like to see people killed in cold blood. I can't remember a lot else about that advance, but there were very, very enthusiastic French along the whole route. They came out in their thousands.
And this is on the way to Amiens.
Yes, it was on quite the way to Amiens. Also, I can remember we stopped in one village, and to my surprise, the telephones are still working, because I went into the house and picked the phone up. I've got the local operator speaking to me in French, and I thought, that's amazing that the telephones are still working. But they were. Very surprising. Then we went on to Amiens, which was the overnight trip. Now,
what do you remember of that? Because that was quite an amazing advance, really.
What was amazing about that was that the fact that the weather turned so bloody awful that night. It rained the whole night. And the chap who was leading the regiment, Corporal Byrne, I think his name was, he must have been brilliant, because his map reading was wonderful. I can remember in one place he got, there was a hold up, and he did no more than go over the railway lines, we could probably all ride in a tank, not so easy in a scout car, because the railway lines poke up quite a bit above the ground. Then down the road a mile or two, and then back over the railway lines again to pick up our centre line. But I think he did an absolutely brilliant job. Now, in the morning, during the night, incidentally, I had to tell lots of French that nous sommes anglais. In other words, we are English, and you know, they were surprised because I could see them looking out of their windows. In the morning, when they captured the German General Eberbach, we had to take him back to Brigade Headquarters.
This is you and
the intelligence officer.
And that. Still Hudson at that time. Yeah. What do you remember of taking Eberbach back?
Well, he was given to us. He was a very surly sort of a gentleman. He had him right on the back of the scout car, although I think he had his legs inside. When we're proceeding down the road, this was backwards, because we'd already come down the road forwards, we're going back towards the west now. And we had to cross over from our centre line to the other centre line of the Brigade Headquarters. I saw three Germans running across the road into the woods. So I said to this German general, I don't know why Hudson never said it, I said to this German general, tell those men to come out here and get on the back of this scout car. So he did. He spoke English, well, in fashion. He did. He told these men, and these men, of course, came out and jumped onto the back of the scout car.
They were stragglers.
They obviously knew the English were about, and they'd run away. But their eyes popped out of their head when they saw the German general on the back. We then had to cross the railway line to get from our centre line to Brigade Headquarters.
Hang on a minute, he was on the back, he wasn't inside the car.
No, he had his legs inside. I've got an idea the officer got down inside and this happened, right? Don't forget we had openings in the roof and things like that, you see, could poke it out. But these Germans had to get on the back, and we went across this railway line. Now, when we went across the railway line, I proceeded very cautiously because the Germans used to sight anti-tank guns on railway lines and fire down railway lines being straight. They'd have a good field of fire. So we went across there very cautiously, and lo and behold, I saw a German walking along with his helmet in his hand in an inverted position. So we stopped him, and I had a look, put out the scout one, had a look, and in his helmet he had half a dozen eggs, which I said were mine, and told him to jump on the, put his helmet on and jump on the back of the scout car, which he did in a sheepish fashion. And then we delivered the German general, we didn't say goodbye incidentally, delivered the German general to Brigade Headquarters, where I've no doubt he had a much better reception than we had back in our scout car. The officer obviously did that part of the work, but I never heard any more about the general, but I did see a cutting in the Daily Express, which my mother sent me when I was out there talking about the capture of the German 7th Army Commander.